with the Ornette Coleman Quartet and their recording of Embraceable You. It's 5 minutes after 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. My guest is poet, playwright, essayist, and political activist Amiri Baraka, formerly known as Leroy Jones. Baraka was one of the first and most important militant black writers to emerge in the 60s. Throughout his career, he's written about black life, black music, and radical politics. In his own life, he's gone through several distinct political and cultural stages. He's been a bohemian, a Muslim, black nationalist, and socialist. Since 1965, he's lived in Newark, New Jersey, the city he grew up in. There he's been very active in the city's cultural and political life. Baraka's plays include The Dutchman, The Slave, and The Toilet, which shocked many audiences when they were first produced because of their rage and their explicit language. His books about music include Black Music and Blues People. Companion anthologies of his poetry, prose, and plays were published in 1979. His latest book is his autobiography. Amiri Baraka is in town for a reading this evening at the Walt Whitman Poetry Center. That's tonight at 7:30. For directions or information, you can call this number, 609-966-1976. That's 609-966-1976 for more information about tonight's reading by Amiri Baraka at the Walt Whitman Poetry Center. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to ask you to open by reading a couple of your poems.
Okay, these are poems from a long book I'm writing called Wise, W-I-S-E, W-H-Y apostrophe S, or Y apostrophe S. If you ever find yourself somewhere, lost and surrounded by enemies who won't let you speak in your own language, who destroy your statues and instruments, who ban your boom baboom, then you are in trouble, deep trouble. They ban your boom baboom, you in deep, deep trouble. Probably take you several hundred years to get out. Wise, 3. Sun singing, found some words. Sun singing in that other language, talking about baby, why you leave me here. Talking about up under the sun, cotton in my hand. Sun singing, think he bad, cause he can speak they language. Talking about dark was the night, the ocean deep, white eyes cut through me, made me weep. Sun singing, found some words, think he bad, speak they language. It's all right, I say. It's all right with me. Look like, yeah, we gonna be here a taste.
That's Amiri Baraka. Let's talk about your life.
Sure.
When you were very young, what was your sense of what it meant to be black in America? When you were a kid? I'm even talking about before junior high school.
Well, you know, I had a consciousness of that in some ways because my people were very conscious. You know, my grandfather was a politician, a nationalist, black nationalist, although he was a Republican, but, you know, before Roosevelt, a lot of black people were Republicans. So I had a sense of that, a consciousness of being black, the kind of in-depth kind of explication of what that involves, you know, comes with age, you know. But I think my parents and my grandparents particularly let me know very early, you know, about black people and blackness and what it was.
You ended up going to a largely white junior high school and high school because of a neighborhood that you moved to. Was that an alienating experience for you?
Well, very much so in some ways, because I think the thing about the junior high school was more of suddenly we lived in this neighborhood and I had to go to this junior high school that was, I guess, 99.44% Italian. And then I went to a high school, Barringer, that was about the same thing. But I think that was then, that's where you're supposed to go out of that junior high school. But I think people were saying then that, well, like they say now, that's the best high school to go to. You got to go to that school. But by this time, we had moved way back in the middle of the black community, Central Ward. So I had to take a bus every morning to school. So that was kind of interesting experience. You know, I mean, I certainly didn't want to go to a college like that. I mean, I got out of high school. I went to Newark Rutgers for about, a semester, really a year, a semester and a summer. And I had to get out of there. You know, it was just too much for me.
So you really had to, like, learn your way around the black world and the white world when you were growing up, because you were living in both.
Well, you see, I think that most educated black people by this time tend to be bicultural and bilingual, because you have to make it in society. Therefore, to operate in society, you have to master, like that poem, you know, you think he bad, he speak their language. I mean, you have to master the kind of, elements that allow you to operate within the larger society. But at the same time, because of segregation, because of discrimination, because black people have never been allowed to melt in the melting pot, there is a great deal of continuity and wholeness to, you know, the African-American culture as an entity in itself, you know.
You went to Howard University,
yeah,
which is a black university,
yeah,
but you describe it in your autobiography as being blindingly yellow, blindingly yellow, and you said that it reeked of the stiffness and artificiality of that petty bourgeois Negro mentality. Can I ask you to explain what
sure.
you mean?
Well, you know, I mean, the middle class of all nationalities tends to be asinine. And, you know, like you say, the middle class comes, I think, in two general sectors. You know, the one tends to be the lower middle class, who are very supportive of working people because they live next to them, they live with them, you know, they marry them, you know, they, you know, that's so that exchange is always based on the relationship that the working class has. And in a black community, the overwhelming majority of people are working people. Now, your mother and father might be middle class in the house, you know, but when you come outside, that's a whole other reality, you see. Now, Howard actually was a kind of conglomerate of all the worst kind of tendencies, you know, first the color consciousness, the kind of caste system, caste as class, you know, the doctor, lawyer, teacher, preacher syndrome. And I came from none of that, really, although we were, I guess, lower middle class. And my grandfather had been a big, a storekeeper in the South before the Klan burned him out. And then he owned a store in Newark before the Depression burned him out. But by that time, we were post that part of the middle class, and we had sort of tried to readjust to father as a postman, mother as a social worker, grandfather as a night watchman type thing, which is a different thing.
Going to a school like Howard can be a ticket into a life of being a professional. Did you not want to be a doctor or a lawyer or, you know,
Well, I never was sincere. You know, I used to say that because that's what you said. You know, you'd say, well, you know, what do you want to be? You know, you say you're in pre-med, you're in pre-dent, or whatever the pre's were, but with me, it was never really sincere because I would never study that. You know, I think midterm in chemistry, I had about a 30. Trigonometry, I don't even know today what that's about. I remember some of the terms. But it was only in the kind of humanities that I began to really respond and take some interest. So gradually, I abandoned the idea of even wanting to be a doctor. I didn't at first come out with that. But, I mean, it was dull. It was boring. You know, I wasn't interested in that stuff. So I think that was one of the first reasons I sort of stood back from that group of people.
You left Howard, I think, actually. Yeah. Did you flunk out of Howard?
Sure, I was kicked out. Several. I was kicked out about 5 or 6 times, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
And then you joined the Air Force.
Right.
And what was interesting to me is that you actually started becoming really interested in literature and started to
yeah.
become an intellectual
sure.
when you were in the Air Force,
sure.
which is not exactly what
yeah.
what I'd expect. How did
well,
that happen?
Well, Howard, you see, what I'm saying, the middle class thing is not about education qua learning. It's about preparation for some kind of trade or vocation. The first Negro to do this or the last one makes no difference. But it's some kind of middle class description of the world and the relevance therein limited. But when I got to the Air Force, first of all, I felt drugged that I had even done that, you know, because that was the stupidest thing I ever did in my life, get out of college and join the Air Force. But I had been thrown out of the middle class, that kind of a sanctuary of irrelevance that they inhabit, you know, and I actually found myself now, you know, set a new record for KP in the Air Force, I think about 22, 23 days straight. You know, I had never fought before, you know, anybody. Now I found myself always belting people in the head with different things. And I think what it was a kind of a reawakening in real life, actually finding yourself oppressed by America on the real side. And not really having that kind of refracted light of petty bourgeois aspiration between me and reality. You know what I mean? It's just, this is what's happening. You know what I mean? You got KP. I mean, I even saw guys I went to college with who are now officers, and I was walking around an airman, no class. And I got into trouble in the Air Force. You know what I mean? I got busted. I finally got thrown out of the Air Force. I would say, God, dog, I had struck out now twice. I got thrown out of college. Then I was going to join the Air Force. I got thrown out of the Air Force. So, I mean, it was really consistent. But the intellectual thing in the Air Force was I guarded airplanes, see? And there was nothing else to do 12 hours a day but read. And so I read everything I could possibly think of. The New York Times, a book review list. I mean, you know, the bestseller list. I would see somebody's name in an article and I would hunt it down. And then all those ghastly new critics were in power when I was coming up. So I found myself reading through, you know, Empson and Eliot's hopeless essays and, you know, I mean, the Southern Agrarians, you know, the Sewanee Review, the Kenny, I mean, all manners of little garbage. But in retrospect, it was the kind of literature course one might get in the 50s when I was coming up. And I gave one to myself for 2 years and 6 months. You know.
So you left the Air Force as a self-taught intellectual.
Right. I was kicked out of the Air Force, undesirable discharge. I was supposed to be a communist. At that time, I thought I was a Buddhist, but they had seen a copy of Partisan Review, which was published by the Congress of Cultural Freedom, which I think at the time was actually getting money from CIA. And somebody, one of those, you know, Southern sergeants thought that was some communism. You hear the way that boy talk, you know? So it's very funny. But I was thrown out of the service anyway. I didn't mind.
After you were discharged from the service, you moved to the periphery of Greenwich Village and became a bohemian and entered the bohemian world. I'd really like to know what attracted you to that.
Well, I had a friend and friend. You know, Newark is very close to New York.
Yes.
And there's a whole kind of commerce and flow between Newark and New York that's always been. You know, I mean, from way back when Willie the Lion Smith used to live in Newark, you know, and used to be always in New York. And all the musicians and things, a lot of them come from Newark. You know, I mean, Wayne Shorter and Hank Mobley and Sarah Vaughan and James Moody. But specifically, friends of mine went to the Village. And one particular friend of mine who was a hero of mine, he used to be a great half-miler in high school. I ran track, you know, and then he moved to the Village. We heard about it. I went over to see him, you know, and there he was. He had on sandals and, you know, a whole wall full of books, and he told me he was a writer, and it impressed me. I liked that.
Did you see Bohemia as a way out of the class system? Because you're really kind of, when you're living a bohemian life, you're kind of opting out of being defined as middle class or working class or upper class. And also, it's a way of opting out of being in this artistic world and opting out of having to choose between being a doctor or being a postal clerk.
Yeah. Well, you see, I thought, really, because I guess I was the most unbohemian of all bohemians, my bohemianism consisted of not wanting to get involved with the stupid stuff that I thought people wanted you to get involved with, was namely America. You remember that was Dwight Eisenhower, McCarthyism, and all those great things. And I had just been in some repressive situations, you know, the middle class, black middle class college scene, then the crazy United States Air Force. And so I just felt like getting out of that, you know. And I thought now that I wanted to be a writer, I had something that I wanted to do, excuse me, that I was interested in doing, and so I wanted to pursue that, you know. And so I moved down to East 3rd Street and 1st Avenue. Before it was the East Village, then it was just the Lower East Side. And, you know, I paid $28 a month for this place with no heat. I wish it had heat. I didn't want to be that bohemian. And I used to stick my feet in the oven and put on my sweaters and try to write on a yellow pad every day, you know, but I discovered that a lot of people down there weren't serious either, which was very embarrassing, because there I had been there preparing to enter into the contest with these world-class intellectuals I had thought were down there, and really, you got down there, you find, oh, the same thing. Nobody knows much. You know, most people are fronting off, lying.
A lot of posturing.
Yeah, people who tell you, you know, I remember this time I tried to get this guy to, he told me he was a composer. All the time I knew he was a composer, so this woman wanted us to do a musical. I'd written this musical, which I lost, by the way. And I tried to get this guy to do music for it. And then it turned out he had never written music. But that was his, that's the kind of panache he wanted, that he was a composer, you know. So that kind of thing.
You were hanging out also with a lot of the beat writers. There were a lot of painters in your circle.
Yeah.
And I think most of the people in the circle were white.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What was your standing within the circle as a black artist? Did it make you any different?
Well, see, most people in the Village were and are white. I mean, because it's like America. But I think in that sense, interestingly enough, the longer I stayed down there, you could see some visible changes in the society of the sort of Lower East Side, Greenwich Village society, as more and more black people began to come in. But No, I think for the most part, the people I hung with, we were all sort of, you know, on the outs. I mean, it was, I got to meet Ginsberg when I first came down to the Village because Howl had come out, you know, and I read it. And I think between Howl and James Baldwin's Notes of a Native Son, which I'd read the year before I got out of service, I thought those were the two books and the two authors that most turned me on at the time, Jimmy Baldwin and Allen Ginsberg. And so I wrote Ginsberg a letter. He was living in Paris. I wrote it on a piece of toilet paper, I guess, to be dramatic, and asked him, you know, was he for real? You know, what is this? Is this for real or what is this? Just a game? And he wrote me back a letter. We started correspondence, you know. But I think in the main, it was, there were a lot of people who were sincere, who were really trying to do something. I know we had come from different places, and because of that, we had different ideas, different aesthetics even. But I think in that circle, those people generally were fighting against the academic life, academic poetry of the 50s. Whether you're talking about Ginsberg and the Beats, or you're talking about Creeley and Olson and the Black Mountain School, or you're talking about Frank O'Hara and the New York School, as all these so-called schools, they were all, I think, aligned in a kind of united front against the dullness of the New Critics and the dullness of the kind of poetry they're now trying to bring back, you know, the New Yorker-type poetry. Alas, the birdbath is overfilled or something like that, you know.
A lot of people were using drugs at that time. Did you get involved with that, and did you ever almost get into trouble with yourself?
Yeah, I got deeply involved with that. I mean, I got so deeply involved that I went to the hospital for hepatitis. You know, I turned yellow in the middle of the night, scared me to death. But I think that was all, I never really seriously thought about being a junkie or anything like that. I mean, it was just part of growing up, I guess, because I always think of the Village and et cetera as my kind of extended adolescence in a sense, you know, because you're still trying to find out what's happening in the world. You're trying to find out what's happening with your own mind. And it took me a while. It took me at least, I guess, 8-9 years to find out.
Your play, The Dutchman, was produced off-Broadway in 1964, I think
64,
it was.
Yeah.
And it won an Obie Award.
Yeah.
It was very controversial. People mm-hmm. were, I think, very, very shocked at the sentiments being expressed.
Yeah.
Also some of the language being used. And it's about a white woman who provokes and finally kills mm-hmm. a black man. And at the time, you were married to a white woman.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you think that affected the fact that this was a white woman and a black man and that you were married to a white woman? Had that affect the way you were seen and the way your play was received?
Well, I think actually, I can tell you, I can give you a for instance that will clarify. Now, when I wrote that play, Dutchman, which is really, you know, coming to consciousness, you know, what are the dangers to the middle class, but particularly the black middle class intellectual? That is the contradiction between seduction, which is, you know, the woman. I mean, because America advertises everything with the white woman. It could be peas or, you know, automobiles. But that is America the seductive. So the intellectual is always first. There's the attempt at seduction. Come with me, you know, we're going to have a good time. You know, we're going to be together. But then if you refuse to do that, you are killed. That is, if you try to get off the train, if you say, no, I'm not going to do it. Now, black people, to me, it's obvious, you know, but I think intellectuals in general, it's also obvious. But I think the thing with me being married to a white woman at the time was that made it okay, I think, that sector of the establishment that deals with downtown. I think it made it okay. I think the next year, after I'd gotten a divorce and moved up to Harlem and we did the play up in Harlem, the play was termed Racist, where in 1964 it won Obie Award, Best American Play. I don't know how a play can change just because you take the A train to present it, but it did.
Was it ever, did people accuse you of being hypocritical because you were in a relationship with a white woman and were this, you know, militant black voice?
I imagine they must have. Mm-hmm. I imagine they must have, but it became my own, I think nobody accused me more than myself. So that's why I never, you know, worried about it until it did actually mean that, you know, I mean, because see, it wasn't just that. It was the whole scene, you know what I mean? Because, first of all, to be involved in that scene, the whole question about, well, poetry is poetry and politics is politics, that's garbage. You know, it's not just the white-black thing. It's not just the ideological thing. It is the whole way of life after a while became not interesting to me, you know?
What made you think as a black writer and a black man who was talking about racial mm-hmm. issues in your work that you couldn't be comfortable anymore in an interracial relationship? What was the turning point?
It wasn't that.
It was
the whole scene itself was not. See, the whole idea of that whole place is irrelevant, as a matter of fact. I mean, to me, most people don't live in the villages and so forth of the world. They live in communities where they have to take up the real struggles to change their lives or just to live. Just to live from day to day. And it's the question of that became irrelevant because that whole community itself was not relevant to anything. You know, I mean, at best, the people that you found who are really clear and really who wanted to struggle to see the world change, they were people you could relate to. But I think that in the situation of trying to live in America, because that's America, even though people say, well, you know, the integrated America, that's America, you see. But once you actually become yourself, that is, you have to leave America. You know, I mean, I'm an African-American. I'm not an American by definition unless I choose to be, you know. Consider the fact that you've already asked me a half-hour questions about a woman I've been divorced for 20 years.
It seems to be a turning point in your life.
No, but I'm saying that's what happens all the time. I mean, I've been divorced 20 years, but people always ask me about that because as far as they're concerned, that was the last time I was seen in America, you know. Then after that, I left. And then it becomes hazy or negative, you know, or something like that. I got that feeling the minute I presented Dutchman Uptown, 1960, the next year, 64, 65. And the paper said it was racist. Well, how did it get to be racist in a year? Except there were different social connections, you see, different social connections.
When you left the bohemian life and living in Greenwich Village, you moved up to Harlem. That was shortly after the assassination of Malcolm X.
Absolutely, yeah.
What did that move to you symbolize from going from the village up to Harlem?
Well, first of all, as young, you know, as intellectuals, we took that very seriously. I mean, the question of murdering Malcolm was not just a public figure being killed. It was like somebody who we were sworn to be involved with. And it actually shaped our thinking, you know. I met Malcolm the month before he was killed. I mean, that was the second time I'd seen him. But, I mean, I talked to Malcolm one night with a brother named Muhammad Babu from Tanzania all night up in, where was it, the Waldorf upstairs where Babu was staying. And, you know, that added to what Malcolm had, with the things he had been saying throughout his brief, you know, kind of appearance as a leader in America. I mean, it deeply changed my mind about America. Made me see America in a way I had never. Made me see myself in a way I had never. And then for them to kill him, for a lot of us, it represented the declaration of war. And I think, you know, the very idea that, you know, here you are down in Greenwich Village fooling around, you know, I mean, I think I was at a book party that afternoon, you know. I mean, you know, just jiving around. Although I guess I was as more active than most, but still, I mean, it was the thing is, but what does this mean? I mean, what is this as a commitment to, you know, the people themselves? And you see, I think one thing about the Dutchman thing itself that people never really understand is when that came out and I discovered that they were going to make me famous, it changed my whole personality, or it began to emphasize another aspect of personality, because until then I thought it was all right for me to just hang out and do anything I wanted to, because after all, you know, I didn't feel any sense of responsibility. I guess that's what it was. But I mean, the sense of responsibility, that is, if somebody's going to stand you up in front of a microphone or a TV, you see what I mean, and they say, what are you going to say? Then I have to remember what my grandmother told me about, you know, how they killed this little boy, you know, at 16 and cut off his genitals and stuffed them in his mouth and made all the little girls, black girls in town, come to watch that. And, you know, why she told me that when I was 10 years old, because she wanted me to know where I was. Then I have to remember that. I can't waste that. You know, I have to remember what happened to my grandfather, you know, how my mother and father struggled. I can't waste that. You know what I mean? I can't be a person who's now going to pretend that those things didn't really shape me in some kind of profound way, you see? So I have to say, I have to talk about those things. And to talk about those things in America is to be radical, just to talk about them.
So you felt that you really had a certain responsibility, knowing that you were going to be famous, to use that celebrity to address issues that you thought were really important.
Absolutely.
As opposed to just using it
just to hang out. That's right. And why that happened to me, sometimes I wonder. But it did. I mean, I went to the corner that night and read all these reviews of Dutchman. They were putting him down. A man's crazy, this terrible language, a foul-mouthed, sick person. But what was interesting to me is that how much ink and how, you know, violent these attacks were, and that they really, that what I had said was really hurt them in some kind of way, that that what I had said had really reached some kind of, you know, if not the funny bone, the terror bone, because there were reactions that were very interesting to me. I said, these people are really don't like this. And even though they're putting me down as a nut, it's obviously that they want to continue to do that because they don't want this trend of thought to continue. See what I'm saying? So I knew that. I said, oh, so they're going to keep calling me a nut. The more they're going to keep calling me a nut, apparently they're going to make me famous. And then they started asking me to do all these things, you know, rewrite Golden Boy, you know, write
yes,
Cotton Comes to Harlem. Huh? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Write Cotton Comes to Harlem. All kinds of wild things.
Did you do any of those things?
No, I didn't do it. Mostly because I was very, I guess what we call it, a little too, I think, what can you call that? Maybe my self-serving. Maybe I didn't feel like, you know, I didn't have to do any of that. You know, I thought that, I guess it was young, that's youth. Because anything that anyone said to me that I didn't like, you know, I would tell them. I remember when Leonard Bernstein came and wanted to do the music for the toilet, after the toilet opened, then, you know, I mean, you should jump at that. That's a great opportunity. You know, hey, Leonard Bernstein wants to do the music for the toilet. Solid, get right in there. But instead of that, I sat there and insulted him. You know, I asked him, did he think he was as good a composer as Duke Ellington? Did he think he was as good a piano player as Duke Ellington? I said, man, you don't even dress as good as Duke Ellington. Now, that's not necessary to say all that, but that's why the rep goes with that. Because I guess what that was is a young boy really beginning to test his strength. And in that kind of period there, in the kind of militance and nationalism that I was growing into, I thought that those kinds of things were necessary. I mean, I thought that Leonard obviously is a fine person in many ways. It's just that I don't think I was completely ready emotionally for the responsibility that I now thought I had.
Did you think it was very important during that period to assert both to the outside world and to yourself your own blackness, especially
yeah,
having
sure.
come from
absolutely
from
an integrated
with a lot of white
absolutely
people, yeah.
that's the I think Fanon talks about that in The Wretched of the Earth. He says the native intellectual usually goes through these stages first, the super integration period where you look up and you find yourself whiter than white. I mean, you find you have been colonized within an inch of your life, and then almost as embarrassment. You know, the second stage then is return to the native. You become super, super African, you know. And then the third stage, hopefully, if you get there, is you can try to bring those two things together and take a revolutionary stance. Hopefully, I've come to the last part of that.
So what does that mean practically in terms of being black, you know, to have integrated those
Well, it means, stances? First of all, I'm the product of the most modern industrial society in the world. I am a member of an oppressed nationality, you know, who were slaves in this country. But I think that we can take the industrialization, the technology, indeed the history and culture of Europe, because we are Americans, and we can take that as well as we can take and grasp the spirit and history and culture of Africa.
I guess what I mean is, like when your book Home came out, in the introductory essay, which was written in 1965, you said, by the time this is published, I'll be even blacker.
Yeah.
And black was synonymous in the way you were using it with militant and
militant,
with radical.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wonder if you still
see
that as necessarily connected. Or...
Well, I think this. You see, I think that, you know, for the artist, first of all, my view should be the most articulate and visionary member of a particular community. You know, I come from the African-American community is a community of people, like I said, came here in slave ships, been oppressed, still second-class citizens, so-called. As a conscious part of that community, then it is my responsibility to make that clear. You see what I'm saying? And so I have to be militant in the context of America. Otherwise, it means my people got free day before yesterday. See, you cannot not relate to that. See, that is to betray, you know, the living memory, and as well as the people themselves.
My guest is poet, playwright, and essayist Amiri Baraka. After living in Harlem for a while, you moved to Newark, which is where you grew up. Did that feel like going home again?
Yeah, I mean, I was born in Newark. I left, you know, like I said, to go away to college, the Air Force, New York City. And then I came in Harlem, I mean, you know, downtown New York, uptown New York. Then I came back home, 65. 66, really right after Christmas, 65. And, yeah, I felt like home, coming home. You know, I mean, I had to get, you know, sort of reintegrated with my own home. And
I guess I wonder why you went back, because after all, you'd worked hard to leave Newark. And Newark is not usually seen as the most desirable place to live. It's well, a very yeah. poor city. There isn't a lot there in the way of the arts. It's not.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, it's poor
scene,
because. Well, it is. I mean, it's a poor. I mean, Allen Ginsberg was born in Newark. I was born in Newark. You know what I'm saying? Nathan Hurd was born in Newark. Claude Brown lives in Newark. Richard Wesley was born in Newark. I can name Philip Roth was born in Newark. Mayor Koch was born in Newark.
And they all left.
Yeah, they all left. But see, the point is they left because people steal from people in Newark, you see. Now, if people would leave us our money, they want to take their money and our money, too. You know, like if we could run Newark, all of those contracts and budgets, if we actually had the wherewithal to employ ourselves, you see what I'm saying? Then, and I think in the near future, people might see that. They might even get shocked by the striking and quick transformation. But I came back to Newark because I knew that that was where I began, and New York for me had, you know, had got old suddenly. There was nothing really I could do there. I mean, I could not see myself doing anything more in New York except, you know, laying back and cooling out. And so I went back really to Newark because I thought if any place I could get some kind of, you know, readdress with myself, if you would, you know.
You got married and raised your children in Newark.
Did
it mean anything to you to raise your children in the city that you were brought up in?
Well, in some way, because, you know, the great thing about Newark, of course, is the people themselves, because we don't have way in the much of institutions or economic development, although I think we are working on that, and we've had this black mayor for 16 years who's done nothing, so we're going to have to get rid of him and really try to do work on the economic development. But, you know, there's a kind of continuity because of that. You know, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I knew a lot of people in New York. I can't walk down the streets of New York without people hollering at you saying, hey, what's happening? But in Newark, it's a little different, see, because it's more organic. You know, I know those people. I went to high school with some of those people. I went to elementary school with some of those people. I went to jail with some of those people, you know what I mean? And my father and mother's generation and my grandfather and grandmother's generation, because we got there in the 20s, you know, which is very old for black families. You know, most of them get there after the Second World War. So we got there in the 20s. We've been there for quite a while, 60 years or so. And, you know, I mean, it's important to me to see that kind of continuity and hopefully the development of some kind of institutional and economic strength ultimately. That's what my grandfather was working around in that town, you know, and I think maybe the cycle has come around again.
Can you explain the reasons for your name change from Leroy Jones to Amiri Baraka?
Well, I tell you, and that was in the 60s when we were paying attention to African culture. We're talking about we were Africans and, you know, people were trying to make us Europeans. And that was, I think, right in tune with, at the time, the New Critics and people like that were saying, you know, the trouble with black writing is they write too much about black people. Which, I mean, you know, you say, well, who does O'Casey write about? Are, you know, Chekhov's people or what? Are they not Russians? I mean, you know, I mean, the only people it seems that would even refer to are oppressed people for whom somebody can actually come and tell you who to write about. And so that was part of the reaction, people telling you, you know, you shouldn't write about black people. What do you mean? Why not? You know, so we came up in that sense trying to emphasize the Africanness of ourselves. In the black arts movement in the 60s, when we went uptown to Harlem, the Black Arts Repertory School, we said we wanted to do three things. We wanted to create an art or a poetry that was African-American, let's say, as African-American as Bessie Smith or Duke Ellington. We wanted to create an art that was mass-oriented, that would come out of the universities, that would get into the street, that would reach our people, you know? And I'm sure the rap thing today is directly coming out of the 60s, you know, the whole 60s poetry movement. And the third thing we wanted to do was create an art that was revolutionary. You know, we wanted an art that would do the same things that we thought Malcolm X was doing and the Black Panthers and Martin Luther King, you know. And we were very consciously focused on the creation of that kind of art.
And changing your name had to do with that.
Yes, because it had to do with why should I be an American? Why should I be identified? Well, even a Frenchman. But why should I be identified with that when I should do something to identify with my own real roots? And so the man who buried Malcolm X, this, you know, Muslim imam, priest, he, after I'd gotten beat up by the police during the rebellion, he came to me and he said, you don't need this American name. And I was susceptible to it at the time because God knows, I mean, I'd just gotten whipped near to death. And so he gave me an Arab name. He gave me the name Amir Barakat. But I didn't want an Arab name. And because we began to go into Kawaida, the kind of cultural value system organization that Ron Karinga was pushing on the West Coast, then I took that name in Swahili eyes, or Bantu eyes, and changed it from Amir to Amiri, and from Barakat to Baraka to make it a Swahili name, the same kind of name you'd find in Tanzania, Uganda, or Kenya.
Did you feel changed by the new name?
Well, I think at the time, you know, I think there was a period of changing. It was a period of rapid fire changes. Things were happening very rapidly in that time from the 60s, mid-60s on. Boy, that was roller coaster. I mean, you know, from 63 with Kennedy getting wiped out, you know, and, you know, you got the all those civil rights workers getting wiped out. And then you got the little girls in Birmingham getting blown up and Medgar Evers and then the March on Washington and then Malcolm X getting killed. And then, you know, I mean, hey. Between 1963 and 1969, they killed both of the Kennedys, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King, not to mention Fred Hampton, Bobby Hutton, so and so and so, and all the people who got locked up. And so that was a very, very radical period, very revolutionary period. I learned more in, I think, 2 or 3 days than you could learn in 2 or 3 years these days. And so I think that was part of it. I wanted this African name. And now, of course, I'm no longer in a cultural nationalist movement, but I'd be the only one in my family with an American name. All my kids, my 5 kids, you know, Obalaji, Raz, Shani, Midi, and Ahi. I mean, I'd be sapped to be walking around still Leroy.
Well, you rejected cultural nationalism.
Yes,
for socialism.
Absolutely.
What happened that was responsible for that change?
Well, because I had actually been working at it. See, it's like, I guess, Du Bois. I'm not putting myself in Du Bois' category. I'm still his grandson. But Du Bois, if you read him, you know, ceaseless change. Why? I mean, he begins as a little petty bourgeois Democrat. He gets to be like a, you know, he's talking about the talented 10th, you know, he's black capitalism, then he becomes socialist, then he Marxist-Leninist, then he goes to Africa. He finally dies. He joins the Communist Party at age 97 because he was an activist. You know, it was Du Bois who organized the Pan-Africanist movement. You know, it was Du Bois who organized the black theater movement of the period. It was Du Bois who was the editor of Crisis Magazine. You know, it was Du Bois who founded the Harper's Ferry movement that was the prerequisite or sort of precursor to the NAACP, you know. It was Du Bois who in the 1950s they said was the most dangerous man in America. Little old man, 90 years old with a little 3-piece suit of Homburg and a Phi Beta Kappa key. Why is he the most dangerous man in America? Because he said America will integrate black people on the basis of democracy or America will cease to exist. It's the question of that constant activism, his intellectualism is one function of his activism, see? I mean, Du Bois' PhD thesis, the you know, repression of the African slave trade, which is still in print from Harvard, I mean, reveals a life, some 90 years of struggle for consciousness and truth, you know what I mean? And I aspire to that. That's in my tradition, you know.
So that consciousness to you now is more of a political expression than a cultural?
No, it's both. See, when I rejected cultural nationalism because it tried to impose pre-capitalist African culture on a modern industrial black people, which is impossible.
Yeah, actually, you once wrote that when you went to Africa, that's when you realized that you were an American.
Oh, yeah, sure. When you get over there, you know, and you understand you love Africa. I loved Africa. I mean, that was a great experience. But at the same time, I knew I didn't want to live there, not regularly, you know, because I was the product of another subculture. You could see it rooted in Africa, you see. And when you talk about culture, if you talk about the culture of the African-American people, it is a working class culture, and it's quite alive and quite functional. It needs to be freed like the people need to be freed, but it certainly exists.
Can I quote you again? You said that in I think it was in your autobiography that you wrote that you and your wife, Amina, had attended together the University of Fake Blackness.
Mm-hmm.
Would you explain what you meant?
Well, I meant we went through those cultural nationalist organizations, you know. We were exposed to all kinds of charlatans. We were exposed to all kinds of great people. But in a sense, we went through the whole nationalist period together. We went through cultural nationalism together, and we came out on the other side.
I know that some people think, why is it that you've gone from believing in one system and then renouncing that for another system, and now you're a socialist, which is yet another system, instead of abandoning a movement or a system or an ideology and becoming an independent, so to speak.
Well, that's anarchism. I studied anarchy too, you know, but it's, anarchy.
Well, but anarchy is even another movement or another system in a way. But
exactly.
I mean, like,
it's
having no system and being an independent.
Because you can't, really. If you could be independent, then there'd be no such thing as national oppression. See, the point is, you can be independent only if you close your eyes to the fact that there are other people just like you who cannot be independent. You see, and I don't think you can use your consciousness to cover the fact that you're not trying to raise the level of everyone's consciousness. No, I mean, I discovered in Newark that I discovered class and class struggle because I saw Gibson, we elected them. We saw a little group of petty bourgeois Negroes begin to get prosperous and get their little Mercedes and their other kind of things. But the great majority of people in Newark, there was no change. And I could see that then. I said, well, why is this? I thought all we had to do was change the white for the black, and then everything would be cool. But that's the same thing they found out in Africa. You see, and I was studying the African situation, too. I was studying Nkrumah and Cabral and people like that, you know. And then when I would go to Africa, I would talk to the revolutionaries, and they wasn't talking bad about white people. They were talking bad about imperialism, you see. So I began to understand, first of all, the nature of imperialism. What is the nature of imperialism, you know? I also began to understand the nature of classes and class society. And so then I began to do some heavy reading in Marx and Lenin and Mao Zedong and Engels and everybody else. And, you know, that plus analysis of my day-to-day struggles in Newark brought me to my present state.
We're really short on time.
Yeah.
So briefly, I'd like to know, it's been one of your ambitions for years to create a political art that would be as popular as soul music or rhythm and blues.
Sure.
And I wonder now if you think that that's if you think that that's possible.
Oh, sure. It's always possible. See, the only thing that stops those of us who can do that from doing it is the repressive situation we live in. If we had independent institutions, Stevie Wonder is the greatest artist on the planet because he can do that. When he sings It's Wrong on the latest album of his in Square Circle. When he sings It's Wrong and he goes from like a gospel over to, Hosa kind of a dance and changes languages at the same time, everybody, they don't even have to know what he's saying. They'd be out there trying to boogie, you see.
My guest is poet and playwright Amiri Baraka. You've learned a lot about feminism through your wife, Amina, who seems to me is a feminist. I think that's fair to say?
Well, I'd say certainly she's conscious of the struggle against women's oppression, yeah.
Did you feel, looking back, that there were ways that you had interpreted black masculinity that had kind of contradicted feminism, that were in conflict
absolutely.
With feminism?
Absolutely. You see, because, two things, first of all. In the cultural nationalist movement, there was, like I said, part of the sort of militance of that was attempting to impose sort of classical African traditions on black people in 20th century. Well, you know, those are feudalist traditions. You see, they're rooted in feudalism. And the cutting edge is that black people, even in America, haven't gotten totally away from feudalism because we haven't been totally included in modern industrial capitalist society. What, for instance, The Color Purple speaks to is how rooted in the old feudalist system we are. I mean, to find people more male chauvinist than African-American men, you'd have to go find West Indian men. To find more, chauvinist than they, you'd have to go to Africa. I mean, in terms of chauvinism rooted in traditional culture in that sense. So, yeah, obviously. You know.
Your life has changed many different times over the years. The circle you've traveled in has changed. Your location has changed. Your ideology has changed.
Yeah.
But one thing that's really remained a constant, I think, throughout your life is the power of music and the importance of it to you ever since you were young. Can you just explain the importance of music in your life?
Well, you grow up, in a black community, you grow up surrounded by music. I mean, because African-American people, because they are repressed in so many areas, music has been one area, and athletics, as we see, that they've been allowed to develop to a certain extent. And so you grow up with that kind of context of all kinds of music.
What's interesting to me, your father listened to the same show that my parents listened to in New York, Make Believe Ballroom,
right? Yeah.
Perry Como, Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby.
Absolutely.
So that's the music you were listening to when you were young. Right?
Well,
One part of it, right.
Yeah, that's one part of it.
So there are conflicts in the house between...
No, but see, you got all that music going at the same time because they love, my parents loved Nat King Cole. We had all his... albums before he started singing. I'm not talking about Nat King Cole the singer. I'm talking about when he had the Nat King Cole Trio. They were great, you know, Count Basie fans. And then the blues was just constant. I mean, Dinah Washington, Ruth Brown. And then my grandfather and grandmother, they liked the older blues even, you know. And you got to, and then, of course, being a teenager, the blues was our language. I mean, the rhythm and blues, all those Bird quartets, the Ravens, the Orioles, you know, and all those, the Dominoes. So you grow up in a world of black music, but at the same time, you're in America, you see. So you're gonna get all of that. See what I'm saying?
Did you ever take music lessons or
constantly,
learn an instrument?
Constantly. I was always taking music lessons. I did piano lessons I didn't like. I took, what else? Drumming lessons, which I didn't like, and I took trumpet lessons, which I liked. But then at the time when I could have blossomed, I guess, into a trumpet player, I stopped playing the trumpet for some reason. When I went away to college, I stopped playing the trumpet for some reason. I don't know why.
What didn't you like about piano and drum lessons for somebody who loves music as much as
having
you
to
did?
Practice?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. The trumpet, I probably will go back to playing the piano, you know, before I get away from here. I'll probably try to sit down and develop the piano again, because I can see now it's a great help. But I liked the trumpet at the time because my heroes then were trumpet players. They had, you know, I had just begun to, you know, Dizzy Gillespie, of course, was my first hero, and then Miles Davis. And they were trumpet players, you know, so I identified with them very heavily, you know.
Did your teachers, the people who you were studying with, know about jazz and rhythm and blues, or were they teaching you music you didn't much like?
Well, they would teach, you know, I had this Italian trumpeter. He was a great trumpet teacher. But he wanted you to play like you were playing, you know, Verdi or something like that, you know. And he gave me this Rudy Muck mouthpiece. I'd be making these C above high C, you know, pop, 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 pop. And I didn't really want to play like that. So he had fixed me up, so I had to play like that. So in order to play like Miles, I had to slide the horn around to the side of my mouth, which probably ruined my armature forever.
Did you ever wish you were a musician?
All the time, all the time. I always wanted to be a musician. When growing up, I really was drawn to the music. I think the only thing that stopped me from becoming a musician was the fact that I didn't do it, and I didn't do it because I knew there was something else I wanted to do, which was write, apparently.
Well, you've written many poems about jazz, and I'd like for you to read one for us now.
Okay, I have this poem written quite a few back, and it's about Miles Davis. That is, when I first started listening to Miles Davis, when I used to deliver groceries on in Newark. It's called Early Cool. Miles, blues, who's little boy with a trumpet bag on High Street bopping? Day of promises and blue transparent stone shining inside you low and cool, glissando, the runs of notes. Each one speaks a path beyond the ghetto sun. Blue bops speak to us as a guiding laughter heeding our hip young walk down the street to poetry land. So Venus de Milo was beauty, after all. Black marble, hey blow, muted slickness, jaunty one, African things. Black Venus in us, blue light, soft like Earth's immemorial laughter. Hey Miles, master of blue light and the turn, hand on hip, the horn hung ready. Hey Miles, my man, blue light and the whirring metal groove.
Jazz has been really influential on your style of writing, I think.
Yeah, this book that I'm writing, I read those two poems, Wise, from the Wise thing. That whole book is, I didn't mention that at the time, but each one of those poems has music with it. I mean, the first one, Wise, one, the music is Sorrow Song, Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen. You know, I always ask musicians, what do you think black people, when they first got to this land, how they responded, and that always seems appropriate. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. The third piece about language, that I use Gratian Moncourt's Hypnosis and sometimes Blood Omer's Are You Glad to Be in America? So the music sort of extends the meaning or makes more clear the meaning of the words.
We've talked a little bit about how you've gone through different stages in your life, and you've even gone through different names in your life. How do you feel about the work that you've written in earlier periods, the work, I'm thinking, that was written under your first name of Leroy Jones? Do you feel alienated from that work, or do you still feel connected to it?
No, I don't get uptight about it because I'm not him anymore. You know what I mean? I look at it try to look at it objectively. Obviously, some stuff I wish I hadn't done, some stuff I'm embarrassed by because I am Leroy Jones. But I think I tend to approach it as an artifact. I did that then. I try to understand what I was doing, why I thought what I thought, why I wrote what I wrote, and, you know, keep stepping. I don't have any kind of wound-worshipping complex about it. No, not at all. You know.
Are there any other directions you see your writing heading in now?
Well, I'm trying to write for musicians now. I'm writing a lot of theater pieces for musicians, and so far only a couple they have allowed to get over. One was this Money, which is a jazz opera I wrote about 6 years ago, and it was commissioned by the Paris Opera with the Swiss composer George Grunz. But then the Americans got in it and said it was anti-American and, you know, asked the French, you know, opera and the German opera to cancel on it, and they did. But we did about four scenes from it in the Cool Jazz Festival about 4 years ago at La Mama. The other thing, I wrote 2 years ago a musical called Primitive World for David Murray. And that was beautiful. David Murray and David Murray and Amina Myers starred in it. And it had Leroy Jenkins and, you know, Steve McCall, all kinds of people. Now I'm working on one thing for Sun Ra, which is called Rehumaning. I'm working on something for Cecil Taylor about the Harlem Renaissance. So, you know, I'm still at it.
This is a complicated question, which I don't think I'm going to formulate very clearly. So if you don't understand what I'm saying, just let me know.
Yeah.
And I haven't left you much time to answer it either.
Yeah.
But I think that for anyone who's you know, involved in politics or politically aware, there's always an inclination to see the world and individual problems on a larger kind of political scale.
Sure.
Then you always have to figure out what balance is it when looking at your own life that you have to maintain between introspecting and thinking, what did I do that got me into this, or what larger forces were at work that got me into this. So in your own life, we've talked a lot about political forces and about being a Black in America and things that have shaped your life. But do you ever say to yourself, what have I done that makes me individually responsible for actions that I don't feel good about now or for actions that I do feel very, very proud of now?
Yeah, well, it's mostly consciousness or lack of consciousness. Yeah, I mean, it goes back. I mean, you see, a lot of the things that religious people say are true is just not metaphysical. Like when a Buddha says something about, you know, the cause of pain is ignorance, that's true. You know, if you're ignorant about a lot of things, you're going to make mistakes that are going to cause you a great deal of pain. You know what I mean? And I think I've always seen my own role as trying to come out of my own ignorance and at the same time hopefully create some kind of literature or art that would help other people come out of theirs.
Okay, I really regret we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Amiri Baraka. He's a poet and playwright and essayist. His most recent book is called The Autobiography of Leroy Jones, Amiri Baraka, and that's published in paperback by Freundlich Books. And in the past few years, there's been companion anthologies of his selected poetry, prose, and plays. He's in Philadelphia for a reading this evening at the Walt Whitman Poetry Center, and that's in Camden, New Jersey. And I'm going to give you a number if you'd like to call for more information. It's area code 609-966-1976. That's area code 609-966-1976. The reading's at 7:30 tonight at the Walt Whitman Poetry Center in Camden, New Jersey. It's 2 minutes to five, all things considered, coming up at five from National Public Radio. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air, but first, let's check in with shadow traffic.
Well, major problems on the Schuylkill Expressway, especially westbound. Jam traffic between University and Vine Street, a 25-minute delay there. Also jammed through the City Avenue reconstruction area, 20 minutes in traffic there as well. At its Oconee-Palmyra Bridge opening around 4:30 this afternoon, traffic jammed on both sides of the river. North on 95, slow between Penn's Landing and the Ben Franklin Bridge. That's shadow traffic. I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM WHYY.
That shadow traffic report funded by the Ford dealers. Tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock on Fresh Air, we'll be joined by two of the members of the Neville Brothers, a band from New Orleans. At 3:40, Christiane Vaillancourt reports on the arts. She'll speak with film producers Ishmael Merchant and James Ivory, and their films include The Europeans, The Bostonians, and the new film A Room with a View. At 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by psychiatrist, poet, and philosopher R.D. Lang. This Sunday at 6 on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be jazz singer Abby Lincoln. This Monday at 4 o'clock, we begin a new round of the Marion McPartland Piano Jazz Series. It's a 13-part series that will be featuring Mondays at 4, starting this Monday. So I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. Dan Lachlan and Ron Barron were the engineers. Production assistance from Millie Moffitt. Amy Salad is the associate producer of Fresh Air. Danny Miller co-produces the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered, coming up from National Public Radio.
Local transmission of All Things Considered Today is made possible in part by a grant from Bartash Publications, who specialize in the printing of newspapers, circulars, television books, and catalogs.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Wendy Kaufman with All Things Considered.
Me gusta la Pepsi.
Ahí va.
Mira quién toma Pepsi hoy. Menudo cambia Pepsi. Toma con Pepsi. Muy a menudo. Comer es un placer con Pepsi.
Some children in Mexico singing one of their favorite Pepsi-Cola commercials. Tonight in All Things Considered, the good and bad news about the junk food industry in Latin America.
Also these stories, the Senate debating the issue of Contra Aid.
A week of extreme violence in South Africa and more deadly tactics employed by the police.
Flight attendants on strike against Transworld Airline, charging that airline with safety violations.
One severe sunburn said by doctors to double the chance of skin cancer.
Baseball back to Brooklyn and this news.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. The Senate...